The date is July 22nd, 1987. I'm interviewing Professor L. Reed Tripp about the history of the Industrial Relations Research Institute, as it's now called. And I'm in the Social Science Building, and this is a phone interview with Professor Tripp, and he is currently in, could you tell me what town you're in now?
Well, generally the Philadelphia area. I have a little office in Narberth, Pennsylvania, just outside of Philadelphia.
Okay. And do I have your permission to interview you?
Yes.
Okay. I wanted to start out by asking you how you came to become director of Industrial Relations Center, I believe it was called at the time, or the Industrial Relations Research Center. What, for example, was the selection process, as you understand it, and whether the same held true for your successor?
Well, I had come to the University of Wisconsin in 1949 as a, I guess, a lecturer the first year and then associate professor, working in the field of collective bargaining, the economics of collective bargaining, as we called it. Dr. Edwin Witte had started that particular course, and other courses that had been taught by Professor Leskehir, Don Leskehir, or Dr. Witte, or at some extent I had also had it associated with Dr. Perlman too, although I was not teaching his work so directly. But in any case, I had a background or an interest in some of the kind of economics that John R. Commons stood for, had been interested in institutional economics even as an undergraduate back east. And so I was delighted to go out to Madison to work with Professors Perlman and Witte and Leskehir and Ms. Brandeis too. I might say also that I had been in the East in collective bargaining some, and also in the Regional War Labor Board in Philadelphia as a wage analyst and an economist, and had worked both in public and private work with Professor George W. Taylor from the University of Pennsylvania, whom I always thought the theorist of kind of current collective bargaining in those days, of the newer processes that were developed in the post-war period. Of course, Dr. Perlman had this tremendous reputation in the field of labor history and labor theory, and it was a great honor, really, to be a younger person on the staff with Dr. Perlman and Dr. Witte in the government and labor and the people that I mentioned. So that's how I got to Wisconsin, and of course, working there in the labor economics group with the tradition of the Commons institutional economics, I was interested in anything that was going on with that group. Dr. Young was also an instructor at the time. He and I worked often together on some of these things. There was an industrial relations program that had been initiated by, I think it was Professor Fleming and possibly others following the war, Professor Feinsinger and Witte. The program had, I think, earlier been involved with some conferences and so on. Dr. Young was, I believe, was directing it for a year or so before I went into it. But then he was primarily concerned at one point in time there with the School for Workers, the union, leadership training group, and so on. So that. Actually, it was a kind of working out which who of us could handle different aspects of the labor total labor program there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's about where it stands. I was interested in also in teaching at work like seminar in the law school, where they can, it was originally labor economics, and the law students that had been, I think, started initially perhaps by Professor Lloyd Garrison and Dr. Witte.
Mm-hmm.
Then Dr. Feinsinger was taking it over, and with Witte, and then at a later point I worked with Feinsinger on that. So we were doing these different things, and then the question came up as to who would handle the center, which was basically a coordinating group of professors from different departments, from law and perhaps people in the worker school interested in it,
mm-hmm.
And the other departments on campus, including journalism and psychology and so on, that might have some interest in these. And also the personnel people in commerce as it developed. As I say, Dr. Young, I think, was concerned primarily with school for workers.
Mm-hmm.
I might say that that the conference kind of thing was handled mostly on a lateral type rather than a bilateral basis. And so the center that I was initially connected with was not so much involved in conferences.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, conferences of union leaders were being handled by the School for Workers.
Mm-hmm.
Conferences of business people were being handled by the Extension Division of the School for Commerce.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thought of my job essentially as more of a coordinating job, both in terms of interdisciplinary studies, interdepartmental work, and also between people in the field, to the extent that we were at least involved a little bit of research and that sort, and also in the academic world. Much like, I might say, a reflection of the Industrial Relations Research Association that had been developed nationally in 1948.
Mm-hmm.
I was one of the founding members of that, as were Dr. Many of the other people there involved. So, this was going on in a lot of places, but Wisconsin was a wonderful place for it in terms of the traditional, the commons tradition,
mm-hmm.
of and the labor studies, labor history studies, commons and associates.
Mm-hmm.
I might mention one other professor that I got interested in more perhaps at a later point than this initial go around. But that was Kenneth Parsons, who had been in the agricultural economics department, had been working with John R. Commons at the close of his life, I think in some of the Florida period, when in fact helped to edit as mentioned in the Economics of Collective Action.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of background that I my interests were institutional economics initially,
mm-hmm.
Current collective bargaining, and the possibility of working with a tremendous Wisconsin tradition of in labor history and labor theory, and kind of pulling together in industrial relations, and that's how it all started.
As you remember, there was no formal mechanism for the choice of Ed Young's successor. It was more or less that by those who were active in the center, it was deemed appropriate that you take over at that time.
Well, I think so. Edwin came to Wisconsin at the invitation of Edwin Witte, who had been closely associated with George W. Taylor,
mm-hmm.
Mayor Penn, you may, and they needed somebody because of the number of classwork courses and so on that people had to teach. Ed Witte was particularly busy. He had a tremendous load. And so Taylor recommended me,
mm-hmm.
the earlier work I'd done in the East with him. So then I preferred to go there than to various other opportunities that had come up in Illinois and Ohio and so on because of their this training. So it was a matter of finding somebody to do jobs. We were very
mm-hmm.
busy,
mm-hmm.
a lot of coursework, and Ed, as I say, was busy, and so he asked Dr. Witte and he and anybody else involved in it just said, look, would you do this? And I think it was a kind of a, the Department of Economics was run pretty democratically, as I recall. They would usually elect Ed Witte as chairman every year. until his wife objected very strenuously, but nobody else really would satisfy the different blocks in the department, like
mm-hmm.
The institutionalists and the theorists and the mathematicians, the beginnings of the econometrics. So, but Witte was a mediator and was very acceptable. And then he kind of involved both Dr. Young and myself in some of these things.
Do you remember where the center was located at the time that you took over, and whether the physical space was moved during your administration?
The economics department was in Sterling Hall on the third floor, as I recall, if I'm not mistaken. The commerce faculty had originally been a part of the economics department. I think perhaps just about the year before I got there, or a year or two, there had been a split with Commerce starting a school of their own,
Mm-hmm.
But at that time that I arrived, they were on the fourth floor of the Sterling Hall. So this was all pretty close. Now, there was a room down in one corridor there, one part of the L, I guess, that's kind of... And which was called the John R. Commons Labor Library.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether it's still around or not, but in any case, that's where the center got its start.
That was in Sterling Hall.
In Sterling Hall,
mm-hmm.
The John R. Commons Library. I think when the first year or two that I was there, Selig Perlman, Dr. Perlman, had his office at the in a private little office at one end of that long library room, a reading room, basically.
Mm-hmm.
It had a lot of union newspapers in the reading room and some constitutions of the unions and, it was just kind of because there was an effort not to to break up collections from the university library at all or the historical society. So this was just a little... reading room for Dr. Perlman students. And we used it as a seminar room sometimes and so on. But, and there was a John R. Commons Club in the Department of Economics that would meet there.
Mm-hmm.
That was somewhat broader than just the labor group.
So you had an office there in the...
And in about 53 or 54, I think Dr. Perlman moved into another office or something, and we had a secretary in that little office at the end of the John R. Commons Library, and...
Mm-hmm.
That's my recollection.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not exactly sure about dates, but
mm-hmm.
I'd say that that's how the center got established. So it was established in Sterling Hall, and then when the new social science building was built,
mm-hmm.
And I guess even before that, the Commerce School was built. But in any case, the present headquarters of the institute or whatever,
mm-hmm.
Maybe I don't know exactly what your rooms are and so on, but that's where we moved.
But that wasn't during your.
I think you see because my term did extend into the early 60s
mm-hmm.
after this leave coming back from the Indonesian project. So by then, we were in that social science on Observatory Drive.
Oh, I see.
And we had a few more rooms there and a little bit of library space and so on. I don't know what you're doing now. I guess probably have a lot more of their research space and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, the degree programs, I think, were... they were in after the 60s, weren't they, in the early 60s?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Regarding that, what were the... I'd like to jump a little bit. I know that previous to your administration and perhaps during your administration, there were some good times and bad times in terms of the center's relations with the School of Commerce and the Department of Economics and the School for Workers. And I wondered if you could sort of generally characterize the extent that you worked with these other schools or the other departments that were important to the life of the Institute at the time, and if there were issues, what the issues were.
All right, so I started in 54 as director, and the first year or two, we were meeting essentially as a kind of committee interested in industrial relations from different departments, had some encouraged joint teaching programs like the joint law school economics seminar and collective bargaining problem. We deliberately did not get involved in conferences.
Mm-hmm.
Believing that because of some some sensitivity in the political climate of the area,
mm-hmm.
that this was a pretty precarious field to get into, to try to do joint conferences. Now, when I'd been in the East, I did participate in some of Dr. George Taylor's joint conferences between management and labor and in collective bargaining. And in fact, I was doing some writing in his studies. One was a study of arbitration of wage reopening clauses, which
mm-hmm.
came out in a series of his things on arbitration. Another thing, another little monograph was in the I did a monograph with the other man that I was working with in industry called Management Problems Implicit in Multi-Employer Bargaining. Wharton School had a whole series of conferences and research studies on industry-wide bargaining.
Hmm.
So we were involved in things like that. But going out to Madison, it was apparent there had been there was quite a conservative group active in the state at the time, Sensenbrenner and other people, and there were, there was quite a risk, I would say, to a state university getting too much into controversial affairs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now, actually, it seemed sensible that the conference program could be handled better under the circumstances at the time,
mm-hmm.
as as separate conferences for unions,
mm-hmm.
sponsored by the School for Workers, and for management people, sponsored by the Commerce Division. The Commerce School had some little, I think they were temporary buildings at the time, down
mm-hmm.
Down campus a ways toward the Ag School, toward the new campus down there. And those, they had some very good conferences. Now, I would keep in touch with both the School for Workers and their conferences with the union people and the management people. I occasionally taught a course in the School for Workers
mm-hmm.
Program. I occasionally participated in a seminar in the management thing, but not very often.
Mm-hmm.
But for example, I remember when the management institutes asked a professor from Penn, a fellow by the name of Gomberg,
mm-hmm.
Bill Gomberg in the East, who had a lot of experience as research director for ILGWU and and was a very volatile speaker and a very aggressive, quite well known. In fact, he died just a few years ago after receiving an appointment here at Wharton School. But back in those days, he was coming in essentially from the labor movement, and the commerce people invited him. And I remember going over to hear his presentation one day and hear him blast the proponents who were generally business people who were top executives of small businesses making parts and auto parts, you know, and feeding Detroit and or Chicago assemblers. And he said, "You people think you're businessmen. You're really subcontractors." He said, "We know how to deal with, the union knows how to deal with subcontractors in the garment industry." And he went into this, you know, but that was his personality.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying that the management group began to hold pretty good conferences that were, I thought, useful to the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And they did it successfully and politically, acceptably.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we had tried to get a management and labor conference together, I think we would have run into some very bitter feelings back there at that time. So, that accounts really for why, in my period as director of the center, we shifted to very heavily to first some research and then degree programs, basically student programs, training programs. And then the students could, as they wished, to have contact with the worker school. I know, for example, Al Bartlett, one of our students, made an opinion survey of participants at the School for Workers on political activity and things like that that were very active subjects, polling them and so on. And others of our students went into that. Now, we were saying that the degree programs started in 56 academic year. Well, so it was shortly after I became associated with the center, actually, that we started working, as I said, with other department people, and there was an interest by this committee, essentially, that we got together to, you know, to structure the work offerings for students in a way that would give them opportunities in this essentially interdisciplinary field. And so I remember distinctly going to Dr. Elvium. Connie Elvium was had been the dean of graduate school, and he was at that time. And this professor of psychology and I went in to see him and said that, "Look, our committee of several people in different from different departments would like to offer a degree program." And we had it all planned out, well, how we'd structure it. As I recall, I don't know whether any of those things survived after years later, but we talked about personal interrelationships involving and organizational interrelationships and public policy levels, and that all of these involved economic and business and some of them psychology and some sociology and political science and so on. And so that it did, but we were simply taking disciplines and regrouping you know, elements from different disciplines and offering a student an opportunity to come up with such a specialization. Now, it's interestingly, you see, in those days, Harvard would not touch anything like this. They were very traditional about it, and many other places. But Illinois was beginning to do it, but only on a master's level, and so on. So we had a little job convincing the graduate school and the graduate committees that we should do this. But Dr. Elvium's comment, I thought, might be of interest to you, because he said, "Well," he said, "I'm a biochemist." And he said, "For many, many years, decades actually, Harvard refused to admit that there was a field of biochemistry." And he said, maybe this is what you're trying to do in industrial relations. And we said, yes.
Oh, God. So he'd been through it then.
And that's how we got approval for
mm-hmm.
not only the master's program, but also the doctorate at that time.
What were, do you remember what the people who sort of objected up front to granting degrees in industrial relations, what their objections were, the character of their objections?
Oh, well, objections are represented essentially, I think, the kind of the entrenched interests of different disciplines, basically,
mm-hmm.
that they... and the people who were very traditionalist would feel that, the psychology, you know, should be anything like in that field should be offered by the Department of Psychology.
Mm-hmm.
But it happened that that department there was quite famous nationally, but it was famous for their chimpanzees, I guess, as they have since been, and also very rigorous scientific behavioral studies, you know,
mm-hmm.
measuring... retina reactions and things like that. And so the industrial psychologist that we talked to at the time said, look, I want to study people, and I'm not getting the the opportunity to carry out the things I want to do in my own department.
The
mm-hmm. department is too rigid and so on, and that this is why he wanted to go into this. And so
mm-hmm.
on the other hand, the department wasn't anxious to have their students leave them and go to an interdisciplinary program. Now, I think the economics department was much more open-minded about these things. They were big enough, and of course the labor group was sufficiently large in the total economics department at that time to have quite a bit of influence in it. And although, but even so, you know, kinds of issues that come up are that for a labor economist, he would have to meet an awful lot of pretty rigid economics requirements to get degrees and so on. And what we really would prefer is proficiency in labor economics, but combine that with a little bit of psychology and some business and law and so on. And we thought that was a more important degree for our people.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, the purists in any one discipline are very are often opposed to these combined degrees because it represents a threat to some extent to their positions.
Hmm. And this committee that went before dean, did it have a name, or was it an ad hoc committee to consider?
It was just if there was a name, it would be on the first brochures that we sent out back there in '56, '57.
Uh-huh.
It was just a committee, Industrial Relations Center, I think we called it.
Oh, IRC, I see. Yeah, it was sort of the executive committee or
the faculty committee. But you see, we're talking about in those days getting anyone who wanted to get. There was no exclusivity about it. We could anybody who wanted to join this group could join.
Mm-hmm.
It was completely informal, and it was a committee simply held together by their common interests in the subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
Some of your questions are very provocative here because I'm perhaps jumping a little bit, but we proceeded with that on that committee basis.
Mm-hmm.
And after I got back from Indonesia in 59. We continued, and the group grew to some extent. But at one point, you will find a little article of mine in the Cornell Review on our experience in with.
Yes, I read it. I have it.
Mm-hmm. But the thing that I was interested in at the time, and in writing it, was that Wisconsin was doing almost the same job with a committee that
mm-hmm.
New York State had allocated a couple million dollars for from their annual budget under the Ives bill and set up a school of industrial relations at Cornell.
Oh, I see.
So I'm simply saying this because it illustrates the committee basis on which we were acting. It was simply a voluntary grouping of people Now, today, I'm sure you've got so many people probably in all these departments that you have to have executive committees and all of that.
Yeah.
But we're talking about the days when we were delighted if anybody would really have an active interest in this. The one department, I might say, that where we had some problems in operating as a committee was, strangely enough, was sociology. Because in those days, it was sociology and anthropology, if I'm not mistaken. And again, you had a rather purist strain of the dominant scholars in the department. And again, outstanding people, no criticism of them, but they were, you know, like measuring the skulls and very rigid. Now, we said, look, wouldn't you please hire an industrial sociologist?
Mm-hmm.
We'd like to have that exposure. I mean, here's Bill White and other people at Cornell, other places. No, they weren't interested. You know, so operating as a committee has its limitations.
Yeah.
But the fact is that at Wisconsin, going back to the earlier period, they had such a strong tradition in labor, and particularly labor economics, of course, but also labor law. You see, you had you had Fleming and Feinsinger following Garrison, and you had Abner Brody, and you had Keith Mann, and so on there for a while, who went out to Stanford. Enough of people around to really make the thing work, I guess. At least it produced some results over the years.
What was the reason? I'm not sure when Cornell instituted its undergraduate program, but was there a sense that it would have been inappropriate to have an undergraduate program?
At Wisconsin, yes. We never really proposed that. We felt that we wanted to We wanted to view industrial relations, the interdisciplinary aspects of it, as a research and also professional kind of development for people in the field of industrial relations, whether union research directors or management officials, or the challenge that we saw was in kind of researching the subjects in the field in a way that would add to human knowledge and effectiveness of public of solving problems. Now, we didn't see it then as necessarily an appropriate undergraduate program. We thought more in terms of like a bachelor's degree as an undergraduate degree. Either could be either a BS with science input or an arts degree. Or an engineering degree. We were happy to see people coming from any of these backgrounds, but kind of dedicated to the profession. So that was our view. Now, I think you'd find historically that Cornell put all of it together. I think maybe the New York State legislature passed about 1947, just a couple of years after the war, their bill. Providing for the creation of a New York School of Labor and Industrial Relations. And remember that was involved kind of subsidized education because the tuition, I believe, was considerably cheaper in the New York State School of Labor and Industrial Relations than it was in Cornell University as an Ivy League school and with private endowment and all the rest. So I think maybe that enters into their decision to have an undergraduate college with a lot of people coming in and trained to some extent in the field and going out and getting jobs, I suppose, and so on.
Related to that, I get the sense, and this is, I'm taking sort of a longitudinal view to the whole institute history here, but that in the early years when you first started to grant degrees that there seemed to be more of an emphasis on training researchers in the field as opposed to practitioners. And that may be a misconception on my part, but I guess I look at the admission standards and the requirement for a thesis And for oral and written examination.
I think you're right about that. Yeah, I think that was. I think our objective really was a research degree, although on an interdisciplinary basis. But we wanted, remember that we were interested in research of, not a purist form at all. We liked the idea. We felt that problems in industrial relations. Had to be approached in terms of practice as well as a study of practice, of practical affairs in the field, as well as academic history. So, and I think this was a consistent theme of earlier Wisconsin traditional studies. Whether you go back to institutional economics or John R. Common's work, for example, with the Industrial Commission of Wisconsin, safety studies. Golly, a lot of that, could be very applicable today. Or the Perlman pragmatic, job-centered unionism studies. Or so that this really was a natural to tackle problems of the world, but in a lesser extent of business and of unions and of groups of people as research problems.
So you were, in a sense, what your aim was in terms of the program was in terms of the graduate program, was to train academics and train union people in who would go into union and business and would conduct and would take a researcher approach to problems or would act as researchers.
Well, I think we were pretty aware at the time of, at least in the, with respect to the master's level of degree, that we thought that some academic research across disciplines would be helpful to practitioners at the professional level, if I can use that expression. I think we did have in mind the gradual evolution, perhaps, of a profession of industrial relations people that who would be in an operating capacities both in government quite widely. As a matter of fact, a lot of Wisconsin graduates are down in Washington. Every time I've gone down there, I've been impressed with how many people came out of even Wisconsin earlier degree programs, I think continuing. And also, we felt that it would be useful to business people to know something about unions, for example, in a research capacity sense. So we're, I think, deliberately trying to avoid a fine distinction between research and practice. Although we were defending this on the research side as being the best way to approach the solution of problems. Now, I don't know whether you can, whether I'm making myself clear or not, but and maybe it's fuzzy, and maybe it should be considered sober. But that's kind of the thinking that that I'm sure we were involved in. And this was true of even this guy from psychology, K.U. Smith, whose studies of motion and time study and so on were very practical, as well as completely defensible in an academic plane.
So would it be fair to characterize it as sort of practical research? You might be. Training practical researchers or researchers with a
yes, I would. For example, if you wanted to talk about operating research papers or operational papers in a government agency, at a later point, well, as a matter of fact, in '51, come to think of it, I was in Washington as director of. Policy analysis for the Wage Stabilization Board, and we had a small, essentially research unit, but designed specifically for quickie research, for developing a new a policy issuance statement or a regulation or a rule of stabilization.
Mm-hmm.
And when I'd been in the field of industry, this was from this just before I came to Wisconsin, actually, from 1946, after I'd gotten out of the War Labor Board, 46 to 49, I was a research guy, economist, collective bargaining researcher, in a sense, for a lawyer who was handling collective bargaining negotiations nationwide for the flat glass industry.
Mm-hmm.
So my job was to, research the best union position, the best company position. He had the problem. He had the worries about what he was going to do with it. So there was an operational, a pragmatic, if you want to call it that, kind
mm-hmm.
of research operation. It was that I was had some experience in now, and we, as I say, either government or industry. And it, perhaps I'm exaggerating what other people felt at the time, but I'm simply trying to illustrate to you how our thinking emerged. And as far as I know, the group of people were, this was quite congenial
mm-hmm.
to the group of mm-hmm. people involved in it, and was consistent with traditional Wisconsin scholarship.
Hmm.
I think that's one thing about Wisconsin in those days. It was a tradition, the Wisconsin tradition, as I understood it, was a very institutional, pragmatic tradition. Now, and in fact, now there were arguments in the academic departments, including the economics department, as I mentioned to you,
mm-hmm.
between institutionalists and the theorists, classical theorists and Keynesian theorists, and then the econometrics people and so on. But there was a role there for accepted, I think, at least at the time, for this kind of
mm-hmm.
On the grounds that this would, that there was a better chance of getting major solutions
mm-hmm.
to major research issues if you approached it in these terms than if you do it in too puristic a term. Now, and let me say that again, this is also quite consistent with the with an Industrial Relations Research Association nationally,
mm-hmm.
which is, if you read their constitution and bylaws, is precisely designed for the same thing, of bridging the gaps between disciplines, but also bridging the gaps between the academic world and the practical world. Does this all sound strange to
you? No, I'm much clearer now than when you initially started describing it. And that it is, I would assume also that it would probably be consistent with what other schools of industrial relations might have been.
Well, I think so.
Thinking, or what the thinking was at the time, and the sort of the.
Yes, I think that this was fairly commonly held in the industrial relations fraternity nationally at that time, and but let me say that many people in many places didn't get clearance for it back home at the university. For example, for many years it was just Cornell and Wisconsin offering doctoral work in industrial relations. Some of the others, Illinois was included in the master's level, and I think Michigan State master's and so on. Now I don't know what the situation is today because I've kind of lost track of it. But we were very kind of proud of our Wisconsin basis there, especially when, as I suggested, doing this on a committee, with
basis.
Volunteers rather than a big budget.
Well, what is your remembrance of the role that the Industrial Relations Research Center would play in the recruitment of faculty and people with an industrial relations interests in the other departments? Was there a sense that you would have any say in the recruitment process at any point? And did this change over time as you sort of presented it to the different departments in terms of what their reaction was?
Well, the only way we could do it was purely on a voluntary or persuasion basis. And I think when people came into the economics department and labor, there would be a kind of a natural, explanation of the opportunities in this interdisciplinary field if they were interested. Program, and I don't think we ever had a lot of problems there. I think Jack Barbash, for example, was very helpful and very active in the center, although he was primarily a union historian and analyst and so on. But he helped us in the center a great deal. And over the years, Dean Gomnitz replaced the earlier Dean Elwell, and people like George Strother came in the field of personnel work, and Alton Johnson, and Philly, I believe, was a younger fellow's name at the time.
Mm-hmm.
They were all quite active in the center, and they helped us with research funds and with, on the research side. Now, if they wanted to do conference work, they would do it with the conference extension division.
How about was it the same sort of, was there any discussion, I guess I should say, about whether the Institute would have a role in the tenure decision process? Because right now they have a limited role, and I was wondering where that originated. Was that after your...
I would say that must have been after my time, because any role that we had at the time was purely ad hoc, and it might or might not have influence in any department. We had very little, we had no influence in psychology, I would say. There was an active psychologist associated with our work, and there was another psychologist, Charles Bridgman, who was more active, I think, in their extension work from the Department of Psychology. But he was also interested in industrial psychology and had some connections with the center. But we never, met with the psychology department in any way, or tried to expand that group, or I never had to particularly. But I'm just saying that there's a lot. Our contacts there were limited to the people who came voluntarily into the center, and this was true elsewhere. I would guess, as I mentioned before, sociology was our major disappointment in terms of having someone recruited in the field of. That would be a strong addition to the center group, and we needed somebody in terms of our competition with Cornell and other places. But and in fact, I don't know what. Again, I'm jumping ahead a little bit. Somewhere along the line, you asked why I left the directorship, and it was in part because. Of this fact that of operating in a committee basis, I was a little disillusioned with that after a good many years. Although now I look back on it, I suspect it was quite remarkable and it worked very well. But I felt that if I had a more active administrative or budget role. That I could have perhaps more influence in the kind of the educational objectives that I had in mind, and so when I was invited to go back to Lehigh University, where I'd had a small connection as a young instructor many years ago, as dean of their business school, which was incidentally a school of business and economics, I accepted that. Very largely in terms of the position that, well, I was also interested in getting back east, but this my reasoning was that it would give me a more, formally structured influence on recruitment and that sort of thing. And incidentally, toward research of a pragmatic business and economics and policy.
Mm-hmm.
They in fact, shortly after I came there for a while, we did develop a PhD in business and economics. I think one of the few in the country. But
Your comment with regard to having more sort of a structured budget was the budgeting. You were under the at the time. I think initially when you took over, you were under the auspices of the president's office. And during your tenure, did that move to the so that you were sort of responsible to the dean of letters and science? Did that occur during your directorship?
It may have. It didn't make any particular difference because I was really budgeted as a professor, as an associate, and a full professor of economics.
Oh,
in the Department of Economics.
How about the center, though? Where did the center's funding?
The center's funding consisted, as I recall, initially of maybe two, and maybe a little later of three or four research assistantships.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't even have teaching assistantships because we didn't do teaching, but we did. And as far as any budget from the president's office or at the later point the LNS college was that's what it was. It was a couple of assistantships that were provided from the university budget, and then anything else we paid for, plus I think a secretary. But anything else was essentially research funds that we were able to get.
Mm-hmm, I see.
So from the very beginning, there was almost no professional personnel budget, separate from departmental appointments.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know when that changed, but it was after I left.
And when the department first came online, there was no provision for carrying any of the industrial relations people in other departments sort of part-time in the department as it is now, where you carry part of their...
No, we didn't get into that. It was essentially, and that's really why we depended on the cooperation, I guess,
mm-hmm.
of the separate departments.
Mm-hmm.
Law school never had any problems. Commerce school provided, let their professors participate as they wished. And you see, basically, we were listing courses offered by the different departments, but simply combined differently for our students.
Yeah.
So we didn't really have any budget problems. The courses were there anyway, and essentially all it was to, getting a few more students sometimes for a department's
mm-hmm.
particular graduate listing or two, and so that was just the knack of kind of putting these things in a different package, and which we had kind of cooked up and presented it and publicized it, and
mm-hmm.
it seemed to work.
Jumping myself here, there's one letter I saw that you had written to Senator Winston L. Prouty. And this was regarding a crisis in the steel industry dispute.
Oh.
I wanted to know whether there were any external political or economic events or crises that the Institute became involved in through its research, or that you felt impacted the Institute significantly, and that would include sort of state level going on too, or that you felt compelled to respond to, as the director.
No, I don't recall anything like that. I'm not even. It's a little hard to remember just what the letter was that you mentioned, but I'd been interested in steel as a back east. For purposes of our preparing for negotiations in the national flat glass industry, I had sat in on hearings in the 49 steel case in Foley Square in New York City, and, you know, made notes and gone over transcripts and stuff. And then in 52, I was in Washington. Dr. Pleinsinger was chairman of the board after Dr. Taylor of Pennsylvania gave up the chairmanship, and Pleinsinger was involved in the famous 52 steel dispute. In fact, that's when he became ill and on an all-night session of the board. But so I'd been involved in that, and, you know, was generally aware of, again, this word. It's interest in that sort. Of course, I also was doing some arbitration for the Board of Arbitration in Pittsburgh between U.S. Steel and the steelworkers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd done some of that in the early 60s and also more recently. But the this was, I think, just kind of an example of the sorts of research things that we would be interested in, whether you do it operationally or whether you think in terms of national policy or major problems. We did not, however, as a center, go out and mediate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and some centers have, some industrial relations groups have, so like labor management panels and councils and all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But we were, but we might at any time, I suppose, have been interested and have comments to make about what was going on. I remember telling Bethlehem Steel one time when I was dean of Lehigh that they were making a couple of mistakes economically, and they didn't like it much. And,
mm-hmm.
But I would say the defense approved by that I was very closer to right than some of their executives at the time. Well, that's mm-hmm. neither here nor there.
Regarding that, this is just a little anecdote. I saw a lot of letters that were written back and forth to try and get Bernard Baruch to come and speak at the Sidney Hillman lectures. And I wondered if that was kind of... I'm trying to get a sense of how much of a director's time was spent in sometimes dealing with the sort of mechanical problems of arranging things. And I know that you didn't spend a lot of time in conferences, as you mentioned, but whether that was
there was a lot of that sort of thing, a nuisance administrative work, I guess one would say. But we were a natural, I guess, to assist the university in any way we could with with people, personalities, or others in the field of labor and industrial relations, or close to it. We were usually glad to do that. Again, it was just kind of a general effort to advance the field, I guess,
mm-hmm.
and the university,
mm-hmm.
prestige in the field, and so on.
Mm-hmm. When the Institute changed its name in 1965, I think it was, from the Industrial Relations Research Center to the Industrial Relations Research Institute. Now, what I was told by another interviewee was that, and I'm not sure that you were even around at that time, so you can stop.
No, I left in 64.
Oh, you had, okay, you had stopped at that time.
Was that Gerald Summers? Was he the director after that?
Yeah, I guess, I guess I wanted to, what I had heard was that the reason they changed from a center, research center, to a research institute was so that they could incorporate the Center for Vocational Education. And
I think so. That's my understanding, although I wasn't around. But, Dr. Summers, let me go back just a little bit, because in the early 60s, I had started, and some other people had started some work in automation and employment problems. We talked even about manpower accounting, like national income accounting, national manpower accounting. We were trying to get a $5 million grant from IBM on. That would computerize quite a bit of information on the needs for a new job, skills and so on, and the supply of people, and try to kind of really an effort to try to improve the efficiency of labor market operation.
Mm-hmm.
In the context, basically, of the debate in the early 60s between the deficiency of aggregate demand causing unemployment and structural reasons causing unemployment.
Mm-hmm.
And some of us, I remember disagreeing with Walter Heller, who was a famous Wisconsin graduate, PhD, a student of Groves, on this question in the early 60s when he was with the Council of Economic Advisors for Kennedy, because that was the famous tax cut which stimulated the economy and the growth, and President Kennedy's plan to push on with vigor in terms of expanding the economy. But it later then is developed by Johnson and so on. It also had the seeds of inflation.
Mm-hmm.
So our efforts were to try to see where structural unemployment treatment could at least relieve some of the pressure or the tension on the demand policies,
mm-hmm.
demand stimulative policies, so that you wouldn't have as much inflation. And anyway, we had these plans to try to work in the terms of matching jobs and men and reducing the amount of unemployment. I'd been asked by IBM president at one point to estimate how many people were unemployed because of computers.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, essentially, it's the wrong question. What you really want to do is how to get people into appropriate positions in a growth economy and
mm-hmm.
avoid human hardship
mm-hmm.
from transfer of jobs and so on. Well, anyway, we missed the $5 million grant. They did give us some money, and Wisconsin did some of it, and
mm-hmm.
I did took some of it to Lehigh. Alton Johnson did some. But it was, I think, growing out of that Summers and others pushed the whole series, which was very excellent for vocational education, and
mm-hmm.
We got the School of Education involved, and also the.
Mm-hmm. So the seeds for that sort of started during your.
But the $5 million went to Harvard for their automation studies, and they never did anything with it.
Mm-hmm. I see. Let's see. I was curious about something that I had found in one of the files in the archives, and that was a proposal to develop a history of the American labor movement from 1929 to 39, and it was described as a follow-up of the Commons and Associates 4-volume series. Whatever happened to that? I could go to the library, I suppose, and find out. But
yeah, there should be a volume. I think perhaps edited by Young, Ed Young.
Uh huh.
And it's called, I think, Labor and the New Deal.
Okay. Okay.
And I had a chapter in it, and somebody else did. But I'm not. I don't think I have a copy of that. I was just looking up on my shelf. I don't believe I do.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to get a copy. But anyway, there was a volume that came out of it.
Oh, good. it sounded like a very worthwhile project.
Milton Berber, Illinois, he's a famous Wisconsin Perlman student.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it was Derber who edited it, or could be even Derber and Young. I don't know. I have to check it out, but there is something.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember, in terms of financial aid, you mentioned that there were a couple of RA ships that were available, but was there, that is an overriding concern, after your tenure, has been the availability of financial aid, especially during the crunch periods and at the university.
Oh, sure. Well, we were concerned, too, and we tried to develop any sources we could, and and I think we did, but the university may have been a little more generous than that. Perhaps they increased it to four or so. But it was always pretty money was pretty scarce, and the Wisconsin Employment, what'd they call it, the Wisconsin Alumni Fund, at that time was primarily involved in science, you know, like, because most of their funds came from inventions like warfarin and so on. So that, but I think at a later point, Dr. Young would know more about how they were able to dislodge some of those funds for research in the social sciences.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be that some of that trickled into to the center. There was, of course, the big Indonesian project, but that was really not connected with the center. I was involved in that from 57 to 59. And
was that more connected with the School of Economics? I mean, the Department of Economics?
Yeah, well, the university as a whole took that. I don't know to whom. Dr. Young would know all about that. And I was a field chairman over in Indonesia. That's how I got involved in it. But he took care of the budgeting of it. But we didn't have many. We did have some research funds. We got a little grant from BLS one year. I remember that. I've forgotten which of the years. Again, it was to some extent on white-collar employment problems and so on.
To support, and that translated into some financial aid.
Yeah.
That might have been available.
But it was a small grant, and we never were able to get as much money as we'd like to.
I wanted to ask you a question that you can feel free to not answer, if you'd like. And that was, who, in your opinion, and I know that you were the third director, so you don't have much hindsight with that, but who, in your opinion, besides yourself, has been the most important director of the program in terms of their influence on the direction the program is and the form that the program has taken? And that could include what you know of the directors who followed you.
Well, you know, I haven't been that close to it, but I would think you would need to think of this in terms of kind of the different periods and the problems of different periods. You know, from the very beginning, Mr. Fleming, the president, was very important in getting the thing started and keeping it. I guess, you know, some people said that the earlier role of the center was to take some of the heat off the School for Workers, because there was some political pressure. But one has to credit the ingenuity and the success of President Fleming in that capacity, and Ed Young and his work of managing these things. And I guess my role really was primarily involved in kind of quarterbacking the degree programs, and getting them started. And then I'm sure that people who came after me, like
Dr. Summers.
Dr. Summers, yeah, and others were built on the budgeting and the, you know, very much were more successful in getting funds and produced a lot of good things. And I'm sure this has been true of the later people, Stern and. Who's our friend in who's Washington?
Dave Johnson. You're talking about Dave.
Oh, Dave. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And others. So I think it's the matter of the timing and the kind of the functions that were needed at different times.
What is your sense of the direction that the study of industrial relations is taking, and I guess I'll ask you to speak sort of more generally, as you did in the article that you published, rather than to Wisconsin, since I know that your extent of your contact's been limited. So could you speak to that generally? Do you see it maintaining its sort of integrity as an interdisciplinary course of study, or do you see it being going more in the direction of being subsumed into business, or
going more in the direction of what?
Of business, and with the decline of unionism, do you see that there's more of a role for the human resource people, that sort of thing?
Yeah. Well, it's of course true that you won't have collective bargaining if you don't have unions, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But I doubt that they will disappear to the extent of wiping out the need for studies of industrial relations, including the union movement. And yeah, and there are pendulum swings in these things over the years. So that who knows? I think that that there have been some problems with some of our early understanding of say collective bargaining in the private sector and how it would work itself out. And
mm-hmm.
and I've thought, for example, that a union would not commit suicide, and by being too resistant to accommodation in a wage problem, that where they would, you know, lose all of their jobs in an industry and so on. But sometimes I wonder.
Mm-hmm.
And but again, I think that these are pendulum swings. I think they take a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And the current non-union thing, I would guess, is a wave. Okay, you know, there was a wave of anti-unionism in the 1920s. If you follow Selig Perlman's history,
mm-hmm.
and the Commons history back to the shoemakers, these things don't seem that new. They may there may be ups and downs, but I still believe that the approach that we made in terms of an effort to combine different disciplines and the practical with the academic and policy issues is a very valid one and will
mm-hmm.
continue to be.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you call some people human resource people and so on, and you may have to throw in some mathematics at times and so on, but actually you're going to be dealing with human behavior, and the events, even in the economics field, have not shown great superiority of the mathematicians or the quantitativists fully to any really very good forecasts or very good explanations of events. So I realize that there are a lot of problems competitively with different professions. I know that that the industrial relations profession may not be at its peak now in terms of the academic institutions, where some people are saying, forget about any studies of unionism; they're a thing of the past.
Mm-hmm.
But this, I would suggest, is another intellectual fad, and
mm-hmm.
and that the basics are still very much as we conceived of them.
Hmm.
Does that help any or not?
Oh yeah.
I might say that there was another connection. Some of us did establish a local a Wisconsin chapter of the Industrial Relations Research Association back there in Madison in the early days. I remember being president of it 1 year, and maybe Ed Young was another year, I don't know. But if that makes any sense, and I have no idea what has happened to that since.
The local chapter.
Yeah, local chapter of IRRA.
Mm-hmm. And you said you were instrumental in the founding of the association
of the Wisconsin chapter, yes.
Of the Wisconsin chapter. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And at the association as a whole? Or?
Well, the association as a whole when I was in the East in 1947.
Oh, okay.
I don't know just when the Wisconsin chapter got started, but it was sometime after I got to Wisconsin, I believe. And Mr. Young, maybe some of the other people there would remember it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't have any more questions. I wanted to know if you wanted to say anything else on the record about the history or about your time?
No, I must say that I enjoyed the work at Wisconsin very much, and my contacts there, and have continued to have great respect for the Wisconsin tradition. At times, I have wondered whether Wisconsin was living up to it.
No.
Well, I guess off the record. I don't know. But in any case, I still have some of the Commons things on my shelf, and I've been fascinated with land tenure issues, and this year is the year of the Constitution. I plan to teach a course in the fall, an evening thing near here, and we'll probably start with the Magna Carta, as explained by John R. Commons. And the evolution of private property and land, and what the implications of that, and the Gibbs and the Shoemakers, and on through the Wisconsin tradition of labor. Now, I may be all wrong on that. I mean, you read Lloyd Ullman and some other people in the current IRA publications, and you won't find much place for this. But I haven't changed my mind.
Well, that's good. I'm going to turn off the machine now.
Sure.